Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. My guest this time is Dale Coyne, owner of the Dale Coyne Racing Verizon IndyCar Series team. I'll tell you, among the eight owners in that series, Dale stands out to me as possibly the most fascinating, someone who comes into IndyCar as a driver. We often forget, because it happened so long ago, that Dale was indeed an IndyCar driver on the shortest of budgets, unfortunately. But he came into the sport through traditional junior open wheel, Midwest stuff. And honestly, I just wanted to talk with Dale more about his rise into motor racing, also team ownership a bit. Keep in mind that among those eight owners, we have some giants. Roger Penske, billionaire. Michael Andretti, I don't know how much he has, but they certainly spread a lot of money around a lot of different teams. Chip Ganassi and so on. And then at the bottom, if we're just talking about finances, we have Dale Coyne. And we know that for years, for decades, Dale did not necessarily pursue the best driver. He pursued those who had put a car on track and helped fund the organization. All that changed a few years ago. And that's where, when I say Dale just fascinates me, and I think you might find him as an intriguing character among those owners, Dale supports his team, by and large, through his own pocket, not just as a crazy rich person who has to spend it on his favorite sport, but someone who loves IndyCar racing so much that he works harder to make his personal businesses more successful so he can put that money towards the IndyCar team. That's allowed him, through that somewhat recent dedication, to go out and hire a four-time Champ Car champion like Sebastian Bourdais on a full-time basis, to go and get Craig Hampson, who, if there's a Race Engineering Hall of Fame, that guy's a first ballot member for sure. Olivier Boisson, another peerless engineer. A couple years before that, went and hired Michael Cannon to really overturn and overhaul the engineering program. So you look at what Dale has done in bringing in Sebastian. Before that, Justin Wilson, some other higher grade, higher caliber drivers. Realize that this is a team that has become a spoiler. Instead of just being the minnows, the team working from a incredibly modest budget with the great engineers, really great driver in Seb, Ed Jones, who just won Rookie of the Year, finished third at Indy. Dale Coyne Racing has become a team that all the other teams now need to be concerned about. And the fact that this comes, 75-80% out of Dale's pocket, that right there demands a lot of respect. Do know that while Dale has large and extreme opinions on many things about IndyCar racing and will gladly share them, when it comes to talking about himself, that's not so much his character or his personality. A fairly humble Midwestern cat. I just hope that when we're done here, maybe have a greater appreciation for him, for his contribution to IndyCar, and how he does hold a very rare place of a man who reaches into his own pocket to make this team possible. With all that said, you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes, on Podbean, on my Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page, on marshallpruitt.com, and we have a new series which we've launched, Who the Hell Are You?, which I'm hoping you will enjoy the debut episode, more that will come. And with all that aside, let's get going with Dale Coyne from earlier this year, April or so, at Phoenix International Raceway.
I grew up on a farm in outside Chicago, where the suburbs end and the farmland begins, in a little town called Manuka. Never had any exposure to racing growing up as a kid. My dad was a farmer and went to college, and a bunch of guys said, we're going to run a motorhome and go up for the June sprints.
Nice.
In Road America. And I said, okay, that'd be cool. I was sick as a dog that weekend. I had mono. I was sick as a dog. So we went up there. It was a cold, rainy weekend up there, and cars are all running. They're all excited about the Corvettes running, and I'm laying inside just asleep. I'm just dead to the world with mono. And Corvettes running. I look out the window and say, yeah, okay, that's nice.
Yeah.
And then the 5,000 cars ran.
Oh, wow.
And I looked out the window, and I said, oh, those things are cool. Formula A's, I guess they were in the amateur racing. So I got up out of there and went out and looked at them, and that was it. I said, that's cool. That's pretty neat. I got to learn more about this. So I went back to Joliet, and I had a couple people there that I knew that were in racing. My dentist was Dr. Dick DeGerald, who ran a Chiquis Can-Am car.
Wow.
And talked with him and Tim Delrose, who was from the USAC days.
Yeah,
he's here this weekend with Foyt again. He's here almost every race. I talked with him about it, and Dick DeGerald actually suggested I start in Formula Atlantic. He said, just go ahead and start in Formula Atlantic. He said, it's a good class. And
that's pretty crazy, though, yeah. For, hey, I'm going to get into racing. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't care if it's a, even if it's a Ralt RT1.
Yeah.
That BDA and the slicks.
I had an old twin cam and a March 722.
All right.
So I think I bought those two on a trailer for $3,500, and all I ever did was work on the twin cam, too. And then finally I got a BDA in it, and that worked pretty good, so I was able to learn a little bit there. But it was the Atlantic car was a challenge. Not to drive, but just mechanically to get the miles in it. So then I bought a air-cooled 328 Super V, and that's where I learned to drive. I mean, I ran 20 races, 30 races a year in that thing. I used to go out, and it would run. I had a guy help me build the motors. Back then, I didn't know the difference between a crankshaft and a camshaft. But I had a local guy that was helping me doing motors. And he told me everything I knew about motors at the time, which was from zero to quite a bit. So so we ran that thing, and it ran flawlessly. It never leaked oil. I just ran all the time, and I learned how to drive in that car.
And was that you and friends, or what was
just,
it?
Team? Me and a couple friends, yeah. No paid people at all, just all volunteers, and had that. And then we bought an RT5, and I thought I died and went to heaven.
I bet.
I started going to SEC races, and I was running away with the C-class and competing in the B-class. You know, I was finishing podiums against Atlantic cars with a Super V. So I said, this is easy. So then I did a couple pro races with that, and then I bought I sold that and bought a Auto Research.
Auto, wow.
Which was probably a mistake, but it was a good car in Michigan. Ran strong, real strong in Michigan with it. But so through all that, we're always just kind of a put-together team. We built our own engines, and, you know, Bertel helped a little bit with the engines on some stuff, and then finally said, you know, we looked at the whole IndyCar thing, and I remember going to my first IndyCar team owners meeting. It was at the hotel at O'Hare in Chicago. And they were talking about this franchise system they were going to start and all this, and I go, it's curious, and who was it? John Frasco was running the meeting then. And I thought, you know, I'm not financially ready to move into IndyCar, but if that system works and I can get into that, then I can maybe make it work. And, you know, I had to commit to running all the races, or most of them, and it seemed like it was a pretty good program. So so we did that. We said, let's give it a try. We did the same thing. We're always one series in front of where our budget was. So we had a Super V budget finally. And said, okay, we're going to go IndyCar racing with our Super V budget.
So tell me a little bit about business side. Because of the many things that I appreciate about you in your career is that you're not sitting here just spending trillions from your trust fund, etc. You realize very early on that I like racing, this is enjoyable, it could be a business, but there has to be a wider approach to business too. Where did that education come from, or passion?
This my dad, hard work, and pays off. And you know, when I started at Super V, I started a landscape company, and worked hard at that. And the racing drove the business. I says, okay, I can go out and try to find sponsors, and you beat on million. Back then, you beat on doors. You talk to your local auto parts store. You do all the things you can do, and you can't find hardly any money. I had a couple of little people help, but nothing to speak of. I says, I'm better off working, making money, and then I can spend what I make on my hobby at the time. And then, so we did that, and that worked out okay. But again, we always wanted to move up, and we're always one series below the budget. So that's how we got going. And even we first started IndyCar, so we're going to skip the month of May. First, we got a stock block, so we're not competitive in Indy. So we're going to skip the month of May, and I can work in my landscape business all month of May, and then I'll be racing the rest of the year. So we do the first couple races of the year, you know, Long Beach and that, and then skip Indy and come back in Detroit on in the summertime. So that worked out okay for the first few years, and the franchise program was good. It paid you to show up, so you had some guaranteed money you were going to get. You know, we'd hardly ever buy new tires. Before they went to radials, we were always going. Penske would go through a million bias plies, figuring out what he wanted and what he was throwing away. And the Goodyear guys would save us. Hey, we saved you some good ones over here. You know, we're using his throwaways. So, and then we had a lot of people help us on the engine side. It didn't cost us much. If I made one mistake, it would have been sticking with the stock block. I mean, when we finally went to Cosworth, and I, I built our own Cosworths in 1989 when we had Guido Dacco and a couple of drivers. The first year we started the whole other driver program. And I built our own engines, and I realized that they were, how easy the engine, how, the engine's not easy to build, it's time consuming to build, but the parts all fit. Mm. With a stock block, you had the gram weight, everything, and you're massaging everything, trying to make it as perfect as you can because the parts weren't perfect. But in a Cosworth, the parts were perfect. And I learned later that the guys like Shearson and Patrick said, we'd give you our old parts. And he says, you turn your engine down 500 or 1,000 RPM, says you can run parts that we take out at 1,000 miles, you can run another 1,000 miles. Wow. So I wish I'd have done Cosworth from the beginning.
When you first came into CART, talking about stock blocks, that wasn't a strange thing, right? Dan Gurney with his Dan Pepsi Challenger, for example.
Right.
So the concept wasn't strange.
Even Penske, that 1 year we bought, Penske built an engine. A lot of rules changed because of what we were doing. There was the declared engine rule, but that came because Penske says, I'm going to buy stock blocks and use them on street courses and run Cosworths everywhere else. And then they said, no, that's too expensive, so they did a declared engine rule. We bought all the Penske's. My wife shot me. She comes home one day from work, and the whole front entry is full of engines because we bought all Penske's old stock block engines that said, I can't run them anymore, so we got them for a good price. And then Galen Fox was, Genesee Beer Wagon was still running, and Jet Engineering. So there's still a couple left, and then we kept going a couple years after they all dropped out. So
tell me about your first, in that 84, that first season. You're obviously going up against the Mears and the Andretti's and, these names that are world famous. You obviously are the minnows trying to make a lot out of a little.
Yeah.
Didn't exactly have all the speed and everything that you wanted, but to be fair, it's not as if you didn't belong. I mean, the speed you were able to produce with all the resources you mentioned, I'm hoping there were some in the paddock that appreciated that, this guy's actually getting a lot out of a little.
Yeah, yeah. No, there were, and there were drivers like that too. I mean, a lot of drivers like that. I think they realized what we were up against and then appreciated that we were trying as hard as we were. They all knew we were trying hard. I remember Mid-Ohio, we were setting cam bearings every night in that block. We had a cam bearing would walk every night. We're setting it, and finally in the race, it went. And I said, I'm going to keep going this time and let more smoke down that back straight there than I think anybody ever has. We struggled with it, but we were glad we did it. I have no regrets other than maybe the Cosworth engine thing would have been better to do that at the reduced pace of what the big boys run. It worked out good. Then we started to do the 89. We started to do the other driver program, and we put, in fact, before that in 88, I think it was 88, we put Dominic Dobson in our car at Long Beach, and we said, we put the best of everything in this car and put somebody that we know is a good driver in the car. I want to know whether it's the driver, whether it's me, or the car. And we put him in the car. I remember his first time he went out. He came in after five laps, his eyes were this big. And he says, how in the hell do you drive this thing? Because it was the same with Little Al. Little Al was driving for Shearson. They had new camshafts and stuff that they ran at Road America. And Shearson comes over and says, Little Al comes out and he says, how's these new camshafts? And Little Al goes, they're really good. I can beat every car off the corner except one. He said, it's that effing coin. He said, that thing just launches off the corner. He says, it was strong in third gear, but as soon as they hit fourth, it was like, they were gone.
So another thing that I appreciate as a larger person, so obviously John Paul Jr. was fairly tall, but not built like a linebacker. But you look at someone like Chris Neifel, who was both tall and had some size to him. He had to end up building his own Primus Indy car to compete. Tell me about the DC-1. That's a great car that history hasn't remembered as it should.
The DC-1 was again came out of needs. They changed the rules drastically in '86. Whole new car. We said we can't buy a new car, and what are we going to do to come up with a car? So we ran an 85 March Lola, 85 Lola spine, and then rebuilt the suspension and all the bodywork. And we just built bodywork. We just guessed at bodywork. Our wind tunnel was a Modine heater and a 15-minute flare. We didn't know what we were doing. We just said, okay, let's swoop it up and make it. It was actually kind of nice. We were kind of happy when the Porsche came out, because the Porsche actually copied a lot of, not copied, but they just built a lot of things. There are a lot of similarities between the two. We built a car on the minimums instead of the maximums. Built the lowest ride height side pod, and lowest was. So that was kind of a different approach, and I think Porsche took that same approach. We could do it because we didn't have the cooling problems that a Cosworth had, so we could run a really small radiator. with a stock block. And so there's a lot of that carried a lot of innovations on it that were, I think, the layer that happened, the roll bar that came out, I think was born out of what we did. And so there's a lot of good things. We enjoyed that, building that 86 car.
I was going to say, I mean, that it also speaks to just about the end of that era in IndyCar, where someone with an idea and, you know, the means could do something in a garage or in a shop and bring it and try it before everything became full carbon and full professional, you know, meaning if it wasn't coming out of a factory, almost nobody used it. Did you enjoy that, you know, since you come from a kind of a self-made background, like, all right, well, let's do it?
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it a lot, No, I remember here at Phoenix, we had the car, and people were over, we had the rear, as when you could cover your rear wing, we had the rear wing covered up, because it had some, like, nine-element rear wing on it. It had they outlawed the bottom rear wings. They said, well, yeah, that's not legal. I said, well, wait, it was the year before like this, and we just extended it up, and so they had to write some new rules for us, because they're afraid somebody would take the idea and go to a real wind tunnel and really develop it. So it had a lot of neat stuff on it.
Would it be too strong to say there was a little bit of an anarchist's vibe to what you were doing back then? And I don't mean that in a truly aggressive way towards the series, but there definitely seemed to be a sense of, we're going to try and push and do as much as we can to what we think is right, and if it isn't always complying with your norms, then we'll talk about it. But it seemed like you guys had a great spirit of, let's just try.
Yeah.
Let's just try whatever it is, let's do it.
Yeah, well, we did it out of necessity. We didn't have the funds to, I mean, we'd love to just go out and buy a stock March and a stock Cosworth and been able to run with them. But we couldn't afford to, couldn't even think about affording to do that. And so a lot of it was just like the mother of invention. Just what are you going to do to be able to be here?
So you continue on through, you know, later portion of the 80s. Were there dreams that you held as a driver? You know, I want to compete here. I want to make the Indy 500. I mean, did you have goals for that kind of stuff? You know, personal goals? Where did the, but I'm also kind of running a team too. Just curious how much, if you're able to separate personal goals and desires versus, this is an entity I have to look after as well.
Well, I think it was both. I think that's part of the reason we put Dominic in the car, you know, and his eyes were big after the first five laps, and he qualified last and finished last. And I go, hell, I can do that, you know. And so it's just, it was frustrating, you know, putting other drivers in the car enabled us to move up to Cosworth. 1990, we finally got a new car when we had Dean Hall with us.
Yeah.
And just kind of went on from there, so.
That Subway sponsorship concept, I remember at the time, Dean Hall was a local guy to us in the Bay Area, you know, Atlantic champion. And the Subway thing sounded fantastic.
Yeah.
What was it like when you're starting to realize that all of these things from this innovative promotion of, we're going to have, you know, you can buy the membership and it's going to raise this much. You as the person facilitating the team, expecting...
The Subway deal wasn't with us. See, that was the year after. He was with us in 90 with Insight.
Oh, I apologize.
With
That's
Insight.
Right.
And Subway
That's
was
right.
when they went to LeaderCard.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. And we had Insight, the Japanese company.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
All right. I'm misremembering my kart teams.
Yeah.
So as you start to look at this team that you've built, where does was the Dominic Dobson trial, was that one of the...
It was a big thing.
...linchpin for
it
do
was.
I stay?
It was very much so, yeah. I mean, because we gave him the best, we built the best engine we could possibly build. I knew everything, the most effort we put into a car ever was for him. And I said, I really want to know. And when we did that, I said, that's when I said the team, because the team, again, we were mostly volunteer. I think we had one full-time employee, mostly volunteers. And I said, I want to do better for our guys and the team to do better. Just take money to do this, and I don't have the money, and we got drivers that have budget and want to do something, so that's when that whole formula came together that we started playing with.
Was that something that you enjoyed? Or was it out of necessity? Only
it was
obviously
necessity, we're basically miss racing today, and I says, I'm still, you know, we're still racing, so no, you know, why do you always ask that, you know? And do I miss driving? Of course you miss driving. I got back in the car in 91 for a couple races because we had to. It was after Randy Lewis's crash in Indy, and Tracy was going to move on that year. And so I did it. I couldn't fit in that car. You know, those 90 cars are really small.
Yeah.
And But no, I mean, it's. I'm glad we did what we did when we did it, or we wouldn't be here today, and it wouldn't have driven me to do what the things that I've done in on the track and off the track.
So you have taken criticism from some over the years for the people that you have put in your cars.
Mm-hmm.
Has that ever bothered you?
No.
And I ask that because there's some where you go, all right, we know that person's not going to become a champion, but then there are others, the Ken Johnson Super V champion, mm-hmm. who's trying to forge a career, the Paul Tracy's, the, you know, there are a lot of folks, you know, this is well before the Justin Wilsons and others who we love, but there's two sides that I don't think people have fully grasped. One, you own and run a business. What would you rather do? Shut your business down because you don't have a future world champion with you? But at the same time, in a business where people criticize everything, I have to imagine some of that chatter made it in.
No, not really. I think, you know, there are other teams doing the same, and if we wouldn't have done it, somebody else would. And I think the guys will tell you that we all gave them a fair shot. When we went to Long Beach, we had Randy Lewis and Paul Tracy. And who had the better stuff? Randy Lewis, because he was paying the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like we were always fair to our guys. It's like, I mean, when Randy Lewis finished his career with us, Hiro Matsushita finished his career with us, and they were happy with us. And it wasn't like, well, I'm getting screwed, I'm going to go to another team, and everybody jumps around looking for, you know, the golden deal. So I think we gave those guys a fair shot. We gave guys shots and fulfilled dreams that they never would have got to. Charlie Nierberg, whatever that year that was, 93, I think, maybe, whatever it was. We ran him for four races, and, you know, he got in the car, and he was out of shape. He'd get in the car, and we'd give him a hard time. We started that year with Lolas, and Lolas were horrible. We bought Renards for him, and says, but you got to get in shape. I said, you got to get in a go-kart and run every race. And that was at Cleveland. And he came back. His next race was at Laguna, which was a long time, 2 months later. And he came back in good shape, and he ran the race. And in one lap of the race, he ran the fastest, whatever race, lap number it was, he ran the fastest lap of anybody out for that lap. And the announcer said something on the air about it. And I says, I'm very happy for Charlie because he improved himself. He ran respectably here, and he got that mention, which isn't much to hang on to, but it's something. So it's like he fulfilled his dream. And if he wouldn't have done it that year, he was getting older, he never would have. So it, you know, we don't want to be a problem, we don't want to be in anybody's way, we certainly don't want to have anybody in the car that's dangerous, but I don't think our people were. I think, you know, they were there trying to compete and doing the best that they could, and we'd give them all the fairest shot we could.
So I need to let you get to a team meeting here in a few minutes. The last question I'll ask, and there's so much more for us to cover, hopefully we can sit down and do a part two. One area that I've said many, many times and will say forever that I don't believe you get enough credit or respect for is you have a racing team as a business. You have businesses outside of racing that are obviously businesses. There are very few people who invest the kind of money that you do in your team with no reasonable expectation of a financial return for that. Because you love this. You want this to be as best as you can. Not reckless and silly with money, but you look at what you've done this year with turning up the team another notch. I don't know how many other team owners would do that. And I don't know if you get enough respect as someone who says, you know, I'm going to make the investment because this enriches all of us. I don't know if I have so much of a question, but is that spirit just part of what makes sense to you?
It goes back to my Super V days. Can't find any money from the Napa Auto Parts guy, so I got to go out and work harder and make money.
Mm.
It's easier. There was an interview on TV by Gary Bettenhausen once, and I remember he said that if someone worked as hard at making money as they do trying to find sponsors and make this thing work, they'd be a gazillionaire. And I remember that, and then I thought, that's what I'm doing, and that's what I continue to do. Percentage of net income that I put back into this team versus every other owner, I'm sure I'm number one. And but it's driven me. It's driven me to build my other businesses stronger and make money at that, so that I can spend it on this, and you know, hopefully someday it comes out of the red and turns closer to break even. But we love the sport, always have, since the Super V days, and we're going to be here for a while yet to go.
Amen.
And that was used tire buy-in, do whatever it takes to scrape in and play naturally aspirated V8 using when everyone else is on a turbo, Dale Coyne. Again, I love that guy just because he's a racer. He's a true racer. Heck of a businessman, too. Uses his Sonny's barbecue restaurant chains and other things to help support his IndyCar team. But at his core, this man is a racer, loves racing. This is what he is all about. And frankly, IndyCar misses more team owners like him. If IndyCar had a few more Dale Coynes, I would say that the sport would be in an even healthier place than it is right now. All right, again, you can get every episode on iTunes, Podbean, my Facebook page, and MarshallPruitt.com. And we have a lot more to throw at you in the weeks ahead before we get to the new year. All right, as always, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.